I'm doing a series of talks on the five columns, and we're posting these talks on our website, so those who haven't heard the first couple talks, you can get them off there if you want to. I'm on the second column. Why I'm doing this, I'm not sure, but it came up to do it, so I'm doing it. One of the things that we're always trying to do is we're always trying to run ahead of ourselves. And this second column helps us understand why this is a mistake, and what it is we're doing when we do that, and what the remedy is for the problem. And although one can explain why it's a mistake, each of us has to discover in our own experience why it's a mistake. And we discover it by making messes and keeping making the same old mess over and over again and wondering why we're so miserable until it begins to dawn on us that I'm making the mess that's making me miserable. The precepts, you know, are essential for this, of course, and so is meditation, if we're going to do it at the deepest level. Without the awareness of meditation, what we're doing to ourselves is simply a mystery to us. And people attribute to all kinds of external causes the responsibility for what in fact we do to ourselves. It's what we do to ourselves inside our own mind that is a source of suffering. And we then act it out. You know, first we do the mental act, then we do the acts of speech and acts of body. It begins in our own mind. And therefore, the change has to really not only be a change of body and a change of speech, but a change of attitude. And the change of attitude is the hardest thing to do. The change of attitude is so hard because its roots go back into the very distant past. And what is called the habit energy of the karma. Habit energy is such a great combined term, you know, because it's habit and it's the kind of force of habit coming from past lives, most of it. You know, that is a reason why it's so hard for us to change. And it is possible to change. And the second column shows the pivot point for the essential spiritual change. Pivot point, which just occurred to me, is a very good way of putting it, actually. The second column, I have drawn here a column, and I've got this full of the light, because they're columns of light, but if I, as I explained before, if I tried to delineate them just by the yellow, I don't know if people would see it very well. So, anyway, needs to be thought of as a column of the light of the eternal, a column of love, a column of the love of the eternal. And in 1976, what came up for Master as a kind of symbol of this is the knot of eternity, and we'll talk a little bit about why that is as I see it. Let me read something Reverend Master said. Wrote in Lotus Blossom about the second column. It is not for me to usurp the place of the Lord. That they go or come, that others go or come, is not my problem. You could read into that more general, make it more general, that others do anything at all is not my problem. If others turn away from me, or for that matter, if they do not, the Lord still does not turn away from them. If I feel anguish at loss, it's because in me there is still some clinging. And herein lies the use of the second column, the washing in eternal love. I offer up both others and myself into this column. I watch others, and watch yourself too, being washed within this luminescent water of the Spirit. The Lord neither rejects anything nor holds on to it. He washes, He cleanses, He loves, and He waits. Thus should we do also with all fear, offered up to the Lord in the second column. Watch it, washed and cleansed. This is all true of all past lives, all the impregnations of from past lives, the deep impregnations of greed and delusion that are consequences of past life karma. We need nothing more to cleanse us from these impregnations than our own willingness to offer it to the Lord and to love it and not reject it, as He does. As He does. His love indeed will cleanse all things. There is no need for any assistance from another being such as I. This is why I started this talk. This last sentence is why I started this talk the way I did. How we get it wrong. We try to usurp the place of the eternal. We try to get other people to usurp that place for us by clinging to them. Then we wonder why it keeps blowing up in our face. We demand that we be treated in a certain way. We demand that we be understood. We demand. When we stop demanding and start offering, then the thing starts to click. That's why this is the pivot point. Remember that what I emphasize is our role within the first column is to look up, to trust that eternal light that shows through, that glimmers through even the greatest darkness, and to remember that we can always turn to it for help. We can always ask for help. I have to say, you've got to move on from there, too. The implications of that is not a kind of spiritual passivity where you just kind of go on as you were and the help comes, which of course it always does, actually. But we have our part to do. You've got to take the next step and make the offering. You've got to say, here I am, do with me as you will. You don't have to say it, but you have to do it. You have to make yourself available for the help, open to the love. And the thing is that love, because it has to be able to get at the need within us, the spiritual need, and that need is compounded of confusion and pain. It can be an excruciatingly painful process at points. And this is where people bulk up and they try to do an end run around it. And try to take the place of the eternal, get others to take the place of the eternal, and wonder why it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Why am I not seeing the help? The answer is, well, you asked, now quit. Demand. Don't do an asking that's demanding. You've made your asking, now sit still and open your heart to the help. Not my will, but thine. Therefore, in 1998, and I was not thinking of these columns or anything else when I did those talks, and this teaching just kind of came out of me, that came out in those five aspects of meditation. But the second one that came out was offer everything, or offer wholeheartedly. That's our part in the second column. The eternal's part is that the love of the eternal is just waiting to be triggered by us. It's just waiting for us to give it an opportunity to work. But remember what I said with regard to the first column, that love does not force itself upon us. True love does not insist on love. The real truth does not insist on truth. Therefore, and time means nothing to the eternal, so the eternal can wait forever. The question is, can we wait forever? This second column, of course, is the place of Sangha. This is what it is to do Sangha. Sangha is not a mea culpa, mea culpa. Sangha is bringing that which is anguish and pain to the eternal in pure meditation, placing it on the altar of the heart and allowing the eternal compassion to wash it. Look how the Master uses the word offer here. We need nothing more to cleanse us than our own willingness to offer it to the world. Nothing more to offer ourselves, offer the karmic blocks to the Lord. And ourselves to do our part in giving compassion where it is appropriate for us to give compassion and not to try to usurp the role of the eternal. You've got to know who the senior partner is and who the junior partner is. And we have to train ourselves so as never to forget it. When we forget it, we do something impulsive and foolish. And then we wonder why the house falls on us. And the way it works in training, the further you go in training, the more the house falls on you for every little thing. Because you, or seems to do, when you get it wrong. And that's to help you. You know, you don't have as many layers in between you, your awareness, and the reality of karmic consequence, the way karma functions. So karmic consequence can nail you faster and more sharply, or seem to do so. And then one bows, one learns from it. One thing the Master looks for in a disciple or someone training with him is this person really looking to learn from their experience, or are they relying on the Master or on the other seniors to continually keep correcting them about the same old thing? Because if a person is relying in that way, then eventually they'll wear out the welcome. Because we have to be responsible for ourselves. We have to use our willingness, our will, our energy, our capacity for humility, our capacity to learn. We have to use our spiritual intelligence. And look at, you know, what we are doing and how it can be changed. And then when we go about trying to change it, we need to go about it in the right way. And this is talking about the right way to do it. Instead of like dropping that hammer of self-judgment on ourselves and figuring that that's going to help, which it doesn't. Instead of just sweeping it under the rug, saying, oh, it'll take care of itself one day, which it won't. We bring it to the eternal on the altar of the heart, set it there, bow. Say, please help. I'll sit with this now. Then the eternal can get at the need. And of course, again, this is what Sangha is. This is what true active contrition is. You're avoiding the extremes of dropping that hammer of self-judgment and the extremes of sweeping under the carpet, making an excuse. Saying, sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha. Yes, I did this. Yes, this needs help. So please help. Now we'll see as we go on how the help comes further. This is the second of the five columns. This is not the end of the story by any means. But the thing about this wonderful teaching is that it takes you through the process, which is a completely natural process. It takes you through it a step at a time. A process that can happen in an instant. But it slows the whole thing down so that you can go through it, learn to give yourself to this process at each point along the way, to bring your willingness to something which is always trying to happen within us. Not something that man creates, not something our master just cooked up on our own, not something I've cooked up on my own, not something the Buddha cooked up on his own. Something that is just inherent in our very being. All beings possess the Buddha nature. We're speaking about the activity of Buddha nature within our own life. We speak of these columns. Listen to this. I mean, the way the word offering keeps popping up was a bit of a revelation to me in this. I have been given a great and wonderful opportunity, an opportunity which is open to all, to know how this is done, to know how to live free from fear, from grief, from pain, to know the cessation of suffering, for this is the purpose of all five light columns, columns of light. All things may be offered to the Lord in this second column and washed clean in His love. The seeming uncleanness caught in the knot of eternity, which is eternal love. Now this knot of eternity is not a very good representation of it, but you know, it's an intricate, the knot of eternity is an intricate knot that's used, you know, in the Far East, and I don't know if it's unique to Buddhism or not, but at any rate, Rim Master used to describe it as a filter, you know, that the kind of dirty water gets put through the filter and comes out clean. And it's another way in which it can be represented, the kind of twistings and turnings through which we all have to go, through which we all have to be carried and through which we have to walk in the cleansing process. And yet everything is possible for everything to come out immaculate, because immaculacy is the real nature of all things. When we look upon the karmic past with enlightened eyes, we see not a single grain of dust, not a single speck of dust. It's not that we're not aware of some of the horrors, it's that we see them in the context of immaculacy. There is nothing from the first. Here's another thing, and it's a beautiful quote. If a man would be truly free, he must not hold on to his petty ideas nor to his opinions. All should be offered up in this second column to be washed by the Lord, that he may be bathed later in the Spirit on the return journey of the turning of the wheel of the law. The Lord neither discards everything unholy, nor does he not discard it. This is the use of the knot of eternity. Within it, there is nothing clean or unclean. If a man would be truly free, he must not hold on to his petty ideas nor to his opinions. All should be offered up in the second column to be washed by the Lord, so that he may be bathed later in the Spirit on the return journey of the turning of the wheel of the law. Man, that is one heck of a sentence. You know, we cling to what's going on in our brains because we're trying to make sense of something. And we end up with a misplaced effort and end up spinning ideas and even ideologies which we think are an understanding, a right understanding, but this is not so. This is not so. The right understanding is a blood and bones understanding of the eternal. And it doesn't matter. Nothing else matters. There, it's, you can make an infinitely long list of what is wrong with the world. And to know all those things doesn't constitute one bit of true knowledge or understanding. Such a list is really just the projection of one's own judgment of oneself. And that's why opinionation, clinging to opinions, is the expression of a deeply habitual negativity. Be very, very careful of social and political and personal ideologies. However true they may seem to be, they're missing the point entirely from a religious point of view. They're missing the point entirely. Everything has a Buddha nature. Everyone has a Buddha nature. Everything expresses the truth. Period. Whether you like it or not, you can bow to it. Whether you understand it or not, you can bow to it. Where's the problem? The only problem is when I've got to somehow play God. When I've got to work out what's wrong and what's right, rather than meditating and listening, asking and offering, I've got to be the one who's in charge. The whole point of this training is to stop trying to be the one who's in charge and let the Eternal be in charge. And the thing is, it's frustrating because the Eternal won't just be in charge. The Eternal will not just take over. You have to keep going to the Eternal and asking and offering. The Eternal is infinite love and infinite respect. And infinite love and infinite respect do not know how to force themselves on the beloved. So it waits. It has all the time in the world. I don't. I imagine, you know, one of the reasons, I think there's probably a number of reasons why I'm emphasizing this point about opinionation, but you know, this is we're in a period right now where clashes of ideologies is a very big thing in the external world, and you know, when that's going on, it's funny how little you ever hear about Buddhism. Don't get into that way of thinking. Don't go down those roads. Do what you in your own heart are led to do. Do what you know to be good. And let the world be as it is. The world's fine. The world's perfect just as it is. Well, how can that be? Because everything is Buddha. All the hellish misery is Buddha. All the confusion is Buddha. It's all a particular realm of rebirth is as it is and can't be made fundamentally different. What you can do is you can accept it, and then within that realm of rebirth, train yourself. And then you find that all the conditions of existence are working to help you train. Everything that happens is for my good. The conditions of sickness, the conditions of old age, the conditions of poverty, the conditions of spiritual pain and suffering and confusion, the conditions of ignorance, the conditions of greed, the conditions of bigotry and hatred, they're all part of the Buddha body. They all represent a potential for enlightenment for someone. But you can't be enlightened yourself by worrying about other people's unenlightenment. You can only be enlightened yourself by training yourself. And that's why this, the entire focus of contemplative teaching is on what we can do about ourselves. And never about what we can do about the world or about other people, which are spiritual dead ends. That does not mean that contemplative does not want to do good for the world. I wish to, I have a great longing to make an offering. Everyone does, really. How I go about it makes a huge difference. I have to be very careful how I go about it. Am I playing God? Or am I giving room in my life for the eternal to get a word in, and for the eternal to illumine the way for me? As I was saying yesterday, what I found in my experience is that when I do the latter, things work out, even if the going is very difficult. When I do the former, when in some way I'm playing God, even if things don't seem to be difficult, they don't work out. Later on, they get difficult. You know, how do you want your suffering? Do you want it, you know, in the short term, the quickie suffering, or do you want the long term, really miserable suffering? You're going to get it one way or another. And this is the path to the cessation of suffering. Because when there is a cessation of all willfulness, of all judgmentalism, of all hatred, of all clinging, then there is a cessation of consequence that comes out of that.